This is the fourth part of my lectures on England's dreaming. And I'm going to consider whether or not this idea of rationality in law is always possible, whether or not it works all the time, and whether it's even desirable. Start with an idea. Not everything that counts can be counted. I wrote an essay called The Unbearable Lightness of Property. And my point was that there are different forms of property in the world now than there were when the earliest forms of property law began. We can see the roots of a lot of property law is either in land or in dealings with livestock. The word chattel is derived from the same word as cattle. The word pecuniary comes from the Greek pecus, meaning cow. Our forms of property now are very, very different. And there's an excellent book written by Zygmunt Bauman called Liquid Modernity, in which he talks or collects together a number of ideas from commentators like Richard Sennett, Nigel Thrift and so forth, talking about the way in which capitalists now use their property. You see, for capitalists, their capitalism is now what's often referred to as soft capitalism. Richard Sennett at one of the World Economic Forum seminars in Davos noticed how the mega capitalists of our age, like Bill Gates, didn't feel themselves constrained by buildings and factories and that kind of property. Instead, the property that they had is primarily patents and copyrights. It's light, it's intangible property. That's where their value is. Software. The very word, software. That's where Bill Gates made his money, and all of the patents and licenses that come with that software. He doesn't have to have factories. All of these capitalists are able instead to enter into franchising agreements with factories in different jurisdictions. They don't have to become connected themselves. They don't have to employ directly the people who are going to work in the factories. The Nike Corporation is able to franchise out the manufacture of its trainers to different factories in different jurisdictions. But at the end of those contracts, the Nike Corporation can leave. It isn't responsible for those individual employees, the individual manufacturers. And this gives these capitalists lines of flight, in the expression. If the likes of you and I, for the so-called property proletariat, we are bound to our property by weighty ties of ownership. This is why under English property law we're not permitted to abandon our property. Like the dead horse in the road, you can't simply walk away and say, I spurn that horse, it's no longer my responsibility. English property law says, no, your horse, you own it, you sort out its carcass now that it's died in the road. So for most of us who aren't these mega capitalists, our property isn't light, it isn't easy, it carries with it great burdens. Unless, of course, we're sufficiently well advised to ensure that our ties are only to intangible or light forms of property, like patents, copyrights, and franchise agreements, so that we can abandon them at the end of our contractual relationship and simply flee the jurisdiction and take our business and our wealth elsewhere. Now, this has meant a revolution in some fundamental concepts of property law. Unlike Penner's assertion that property is anything which can be transferred, we can see in cases like Don King and Warren that non-transferable contracts are capable of constituting the subject matter of a trust, because it's the benefit flowing from that contract which is taken to be the property settled on trust, and not the contract itself. And this is an idea we can see in cases like Fletcher and Fletcher, Swift and Dairywise, Celtic Extraction, so on and so on. It's soft property that's owned. It's soft property ownership. And then we look at cases like the local authority swaps cases and see the difficulties which some of this very modern property has caused to the English courts. The interest rate swap in West Deutsche Landesbank and Islington was held off balance sheet as though it didn't exist. At the time, there was no known rule as to how one had to deal with accounting for interest rate swaps. So it simply is pretended that it just didn't exist. Now, this interest rate swap caused money to be paid from West Deutsche to Islington, both to alter the interest profile of Islington's outstanding debts and to make an off-balance sheet loan from West Deutsche to Islington. Now, when Lord Brown Wilkinson considered whether or not this money could be traced, his lordship began by analogising these electronic funds transfers, these incredibly complex interest rate swaps, with, quote, a stolen bag of coins. To our property lawyers, then, all property is to be conceived of, to be treated as being tangible, even when, like interest rate swaps, it is intangible and treated even by the accountants as though it doesn't exist. Let's think about this same idea in a different way. Certainty is said by Professor Good in his book Commercial Law to be the philosophy of commercial law. So we would expect a rule which bolstered certainty of subject matter in trust law to be popular with commercial lawyers. So in Re Goldcorp, we see the need for the identity of the property which is to be settled on trust to be clearly identified, to be clearly segregated. In that case, we're dealing with a very heavy form of chattel, bullion. Now, in Hunter and Moss in the Court of Appeal, it suggested that there is no need for the separate identification of the property which is to be settled on trust. In that case, we're dealing with securities. The property is necessarily light. Now, however, when we look at the case more closely in Hunter and Moss, Lord Justice Dillon doesn't actually say that. He doesn't say, I want to treat light property or intangible property in a different way. His argument is actually much weaker than that. He tries in a very feeble way to distinguish cases involving chattels from cases where there aren't chattels. But he makes that distinction passively rather than actively if you actually read his judgment. He seeks merely to distinguish other cases without importantly explaining why. Instead, what he's really doing is seeking to do equity by ensuring that an employee is paid the value to which he is entitled under his employment contract. It's as though property law may not be used as an engine of fraud. That's really what's going on with Lord Justice Dillon. And he might have been better off using some kind of constructive trust idea. Ironically, it's the commercial lawyers, with their lust for certainty, apparently, who accept Hunter and Moss as being a good rule because they hope it gives them security. And oddly, in the great books written by Professor Good, Professor Wood, Dr. Benjamin, they use expressions like case law provides that, without seemingly the need to delve more deeply into the content of the decisions. There are further ironies in relation to how the uncertificated securities regulations would require these shares to be transferred in the modern context, but we haven't got time to go into that just now. The point I want to make is that liquidity is the key metaphor for our social relationships now, and for our attitude to property. So I have this very modern approach in Hunter and Moss, dealing with this light property in a different way, Don King and Warren, treating property now as not even needing to be something which is capable of transfer, as long as it's something which can earn a profit. That is enough to constitute something proper as property. And yet when we think about the way in which we as human beings, as ordinary consumers, you know, living our normal lives, tend to treat our property, there's this idea of compulsory obsolescence built in. When you buy a kettle, when you buy a toaster, you're always sold a warranty with it because you know it's not going to last forever. Compulsory obsolescence, as Baudrillard has described this, is built into all of our property. We expect our property to break. And this means that our relationship with that property is now very different from what previous generations would have expected. Gone are the days when you had a shirt and you washed it every night and got up and put it on again the next morning. And you go and buy another one. And the fashions change. You need a new shirt. Manufacturers are laughing at us as we keep foolishly having these very loose ties now with our property. There's none of the same engagement. We have in a subtle way become like Bill Gates. We don't feel the weight of a lot of this property. Our homes, of course, something slightly different. Although even in the UK, of course, and buying and selling your house has become a huge part of the culture for a very large number of people. Property is therefore about much more than simply ownership. It may be about recovering damage in relation to a contract for the sale of property, or it may be about tracing into substitute property, which will provide us with property of equivalent value, or it may be about emotional or sentimental attachment to property, for example, in relation to our homes. Consequently, property law is not limited to questions of who owns this thing, but rather it relates to how do I want to deal with my rights in relation to this thing as part of my life more generally. So it's not a civil code lawyer's look at property law, it's just, is this mine or is this hers? It's what rights do I have in relation to this property and how are they realised? Hence the oddity in relation to tracing property rights in equity, of having some remedies which are not proprietary. You have the lien, you have the charge, for example, or which are not proprietary in the same ways. So the charge, for example, is only strictly a proprietary right once the court gives an order that that property can be seized and realised. It's a very different notion of property rights from, for example, being a beneficiary under a constructive trust, where a court of equity will recognise that you have some ownership in equity of that property. And that, again, is different from being the owner of the absolute title on that property. Thus, the charge gives a right to property only on an application to the court, regardless of what the House of Lords says in Spectrum Plus. The lien gives only a right to possession. Constructive trust gives a proprietary right, but one not identical to having absolute title. So our property law is not about imposing order in advance. It's about resolving disputes by giving litigants the tools with which they can achieve their objectives. There are contexts in which our property law has always been irrational. I'm thinking of corpses and bona vacantia, or if you prefer, flogging dead horses and butterflies. Come to that next. Briefly put, you see, I'm never convinced by schemes of thought which promise total certainty based on complete rationality. What I mean is that all of those positivist systems like restitution of unjust enrichment, which claim to be able to produce complete taxonomies, are in fact blind to the normal chaos of existence, the inherent role of change, and they seek to conceal or ignore their own value judgments. I'll show you that property law has lacunae in it, which just demonstrate that it's irrational and in ways that we're probably quite happy with. Let's think about dead bodies, corpses. There's no property in a corpse. So who owns the corpse in the sense of who bears the burdens associated with it? For example, who is obliged to ensure its burial and so on and so forth as a matter of property law? Well, if nobody owns a corpse, then we have matter, material, that nobody owns in relation to which nobody bears that obligation as a question of property law. A corpse may not own property, so a corpse doesn't own its coffin or funeral shroud, although the grave itself is usually leased, typically to a next of kin. Therefore, a corpse has no rights, because a corpse can't own property. It's difficult to see who else does own that property. Coffin, the shroud, the corpse itself. And yet to scupper thinkers like Hofeld, there are others who may owe obligations to a corpse. So even though the corpse has no rights, it may be owed obligations. For example, in the UK Ministry of Defence's manual of armed property in the law on armed conflict generally, there was an obligation not to interfere with a corpse. It's an irony also that we have an obligation not to interfere with a corpse, which one can understand, but no similar obligation not to interfere with a living person before they become a corpse in an armed conflict. So on the one hand, we may not abandon property, for example, the dead horse problem, but nobody bears such burdens of ownership in relation to a human body. And this is queasiness. We can see why the rule is like this. But rationality has just descended and disappeared at this point. We have to acknowledge that. There's another odd illogicality in property law. When a horse, which is personal property, eats hay, which is also personal property, digests it and then defecates, what's produced falls on the land and becomes real property. How does that work? Bona vacantia. This rule that if property is owned, for example, by an association which becomes moribund, ceases to exist, has no further members, what happens to that property? Answer, it passes bona vacantia, meaning it goes to the Queen. And in practice, it goes to the Duchy of Cornwall and to Prince Charles. Now, the logic of property law has exploded when we recognise that the Queen has residual rights in all property in England and Wales. The shoes you're wearing, the top you're wearing, the chair on which you're sitting listening to this, the MP3 player or computer through which you're hearing it, is actually ultimately owned by the Queen. Because if nobody is the owner of any of those items of property, they revert to Her Majesty. Now all logic has gone. Property law is then just a second dimension of residual monarchical power at that point in time. It becomes even odder. What if somebody is using English law to decide a question relating to parties, for example, to a pension fund in Jamaica, as in Air Jamaica and Charlton? No surprise that Lord Millet in that case decided not to apply the Bona Vacantia principle to say the Jamaican pension fund should pass to the English Queen, whereas Lord Brown Wilkinson in West Deutschland's